This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello, welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Douglas Impuga, and here is what's coming up.
It's been more than a half century since astronauts journeyed to the moon. Well, folks, that's about to change.
That's Bill Nelson, administrator of the National Aeronautics and Space Administration, on plans for a mission around the moon next year. Also, former U.S. President Donald Trump is in court to hear charges against him. And Australia announces new landmine detection technology. All this and more coming up on Africa News Tonight. Former U.S. President Donald Trump has arrived at a Manhattan courthouse where he's being arraigned on about 30 felony charges. I reached VOA's Tina Trin, who is at the courthouse, to find out what's going on there amid tight security and large crowds in a case that underscores America's deep political divisions. Welcome to the show, Tina.
Hi, thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Now, Tina, tell us what's happening now there at the courthouse.
Well, I'm outside the courthouse right now, and I can tell you that it is a circus. It is just a large crowd of people have gathered. Anything and everybody who is to come out today seems to have come out, whether to protest against Trump or whether to show their support for Trump. There are approximately, I would say, at least 500 people gathered here. Police were expecting a crowd of 2,000, and that probably has come close in terms of the people filtering in and out of the surrounding area. I can tell you that it is quite chaotic, but with the security helicopters circling above since Trump arrived moments ago to be arraigned, and just the crowds of onlookers who are, have come to gawk and to kind of take it all in, to the media, the throngs of media that are waiting in anticipation. It's kind of a madhouse out here.
I see. So generally, what has the situation been like there today?
Sorry?
How has the security been? The security?
Security is high, on high alert, and it's quite tight around the surrounding areas around the courthouse. There are boxes that are blocked off. There are metal barricades all over the place, redirecting pedestrian traffic. And there's just a constant stream of people passing through, whether they're journalists, onlookers, protesters, supporters. It's just been throngs and throngs of people walking in and around the surrounding areas.
And finally, are there protesters or many onlookers waiting for news out of the arraignment?
Yeah, it looks to be a mix of anybody, everybody and anybody today. So you have just as many onlookers as you do protesters, as you do journalists and policemen. So it's quite the scene out here.
Thanks, Tina.
Thank you.
Yeah, that was VOA's Tina Trin speaking with me by phone from the courthouse in Manhattan. The arraignment makes Trump the only former president ever indicted. The exact charges had not been unsealed until today, but are believed to center on hush money payments to an adult film star. American historian Alan Lichman, who teaches at American University in Washington, tells VOA's Carol Van Damme that the commentary on the upcoming indictment has been, in his words, unbelievably irresponsible.
Even from the mainstream media, people, commentators, including very erudite ones, have made all kinds of assumptions about this case without seeing the charges and without seeing the evidence. I believe that the case is going to be far more serious than commentators have led us to believe. I don't think it's going to turn solely on a campaign finance violation. I think it will include some pretty substantial financial crimes as well, perhaps even tax evasion, which is what they got Al Capone on and which is what they got Spiro Agnew on when he resigned his vice presidency under Richard Nixon.
I was going to ask you that because nobody really knows. It's all sealed still. There have been already these serious charges that have been leveled. They've been talked about tax fraud. So that could be rolled up into this, right?
Absolutely. Let's not forget the Trump business was already found to be criminally liable by a jury on multiple counts of tax fraud. It was a criminal enterprise, and it had to pay the maximum fine under New York state law. I would not be surprised at all if some of those same charges come up in this indictment.
These charges don't stand alone. There's these classified documents found at Mar-a-Lago that you're obviously aware of, the special grand jury in Georgia over alleged election interference by Trump and his allies. Some people say this isn't really the most serious thing. What do you see as the most damaging charges that may still be on the horizon against Trump in terms of the 2024 presidential race?
Sure. First of all, I don't dismiss these charges as trivial. This was kind of the first maneuver back in 2016 that Trump made to illegally try to seize and keep power. A lot of these other things flowed from that. But clearly, the most serious charge would be inciting an insurrection to overturn our democracy. You know, there has not been a charge that serious against a political leader since the very beginning of the 1800s, when former Vice President Aaron Burr was charged with treason. That would be an extraordinarily serious charge that goes to the heart of the survival of our democracy. I want to read you a quote to put all this in perspective. "We cannot have one law for the ruler and another for the ruled. If that understanding is lost, the American democratic experiment and the freedom it guarantees is in jeopardy." You may think that's some Democrat criticizing Republicans today. It is not. It's from the 1990s. It's U.S. Representative Henry Hyde, one of the most influential Republicans in the nation, talking about allegations of crime against the then sitting president, Bill Clinton.
That was American historian Alan Littman. He was speaking with my colleague Cara Van Dam this past hour. Cameroon says fighting between troops and rebels is slowing the construction of homes, schools, hospitals, and other public buildings in its troubled western regions. Authorities say in the 3 years since the launch of a reconstruction plan for thousands of homes and hundreds of public buildings damaged in the seven-year separate conflict, less than 100 have been rebuilt. Moki Edwin Kinzika reports from Yaoundé, Cameroon.
My madam. In a broadcast on Cameroon State Media Tuesday, 50 children sang in their classroom at the Cameroon Baptist Convention Inclusive Primary School. The children sang that they love their school because without it, they would not be able to count from 1 to 10 and to speak English well. Vega Gladys is the head teacher at the school in Bamenda, the capital of Cameroon's mostly English-speaking northwest region. She says the government repaired the school last year after it was damaged in 2018 during clashes between troops and Anglophone separatists.
The reconstruction work by the government has been a boast in that the children have 9 classrooms that they can sit freely. There were about 100 benches donated to decongest the classrooms, and the children's performance is increasing.
Vega said the number of children in the school has increased from tens of students in 2018 to several hundred this year, some of them displaced from ongoing fighting. But the school is one of only 60 rebuilt, while hundreds of others were abandoned. Rebels on social media have vowed to make the English-speaking northwest and southwest regions a breakaway nation they call Ambazonia. The rebels say government schools and offices are legitimate targets as they are used by the French-speaking majority to suppress the English-speaking minority, a notion which authorities reject. Yaoundé in 2020 launched a reconstruction and development plan for the northwest and southwest regions. The government promised to reconstruct 12,000 private homes, schools, hospitals, bridges, and markets that were destroyed or damaged in the fighting. But deputy coordinator of the reconstruction plan, John Donatus, says so far they have built less than 100. He blames ongoing fighting for the slow pace and says rebels regularly seize and destroy construction materials and abduct workers for ransom.
We are at the recovery phase of the plan to bring back the two regions to where they were before the crisis. And I think that it is the interest of every son and daughter of our regions to come on board so that we get this done. I will equally call on children who are in the bush that it is time for them to come out so that our people benefit from this. Some of the areas are still hostile, and we have difficulties penetrating those areas.
After a visit to the northwest and southwest regions last week, officials said the construction plan will need an additional $100 million to rebuild from the 7 years of fighting. The original plan called for $150 million in rebuilding costs. Cameroon says it will provide 70% of the funds, while the rest will be covered by international donors, including the UN, France and Japan, and private companies, both local and foreign. Cameroon's president, Paul Biya, announced the reconstruction plan in 2020 after a national dialogue to solve the conflict, which separatists did not attend. The International Crisis Group estimates the conflict has killed about 6,000 people and displaced more than 500,000 in Cameroon's western regions. Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Yaoundé, Cameroon.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight. I'm Douglas Impuga in Washington. Education and literacy are a challenge in rural Africa, where teachers and literacy are often lacking and many students speak languages different from their country's primary tongue. A startup in Kenya is tackling the problem by providing learning software in multiple languages on thousands of solar-powered tablet computers. Ahmed Hussein reports from Wajir County, Kenya.
Young learners learn lessons on computer tablets at Lehele Primary School in Kenya's Wajir County. They are using an app called Mluga, which translates lessons in English and Swahili, the two main languages of instruction in Kenya, into other native languages. The app developers put the software on solar-powered tablets for learners who have no ready access to electricity. Abdinur Ali Mahdi is the app developer.
Because of that connectivity issues, we made the app offline, which means you don't need internet to access it. And then we also have portable solar panels to also charge the tablet.
Over 70% of learners in northern Kenya reside in places without electricity, which initially posed a huge problem for Mluga users, but now they can easily access its content. Teachers say the app has greatly enhanced learning. Eric Ocheng is the deputy principal at Lehele Primary School.
The initiative so far is going to help these kids. So far we have seen the kids are mastering. It will also improve on the enrollment of our kids here. It will sharpen the kids' mind. It also isn't the work of the teacher.
Due to poor infrastructure and lack of teachers in schools, children in northeast Kenya must learn in these conditions. Ali Mahdi told VOA that his company plans to reach more pupils in remote areas so they can learn in their first languages.
We have piloted in the Somali language. So in the coming few months, we'll also go to the other part of the country where we have the Maasai community and also pilot there. And then we move to Isiolo, Marsabit and Mandera, where we have Borana communities, and we are going to roll out. So by the end of this year, we are hoping to give out more than 3,000 tablets.
Local communities or non-governmental organizations usually pay for the tablets. According to UNICEF, one of the fundamental challenges of learning in sub-Saharan Africa is that the language of instruction often differs from the children's mother tongue. Ahmed Madei is an education researcher.
With the new curriculum now, there is a focus on indigenous languages. And the use of now, the fact that Mluga is bringing on board the access to translation services. Because when you teach a child at that formative age in their mother tongue, even their understanding, their access, their capacity significantly improves.
Early Childhood Development Education, or ECD, in Kenya is not centralized, and experts say counties need to put more funds into schools and pre-primary school education. Ahmed Wadere is a county executive committee member for education in Wajir County.
There are so many apps that have been are being in use at the moment. In the near future, we intend to put the digital system in place. As young as they are in ECD sectors, our plans is that they become a bit digitally upgraded even as they go to grade 1 and 2.
Despite the myriad of challenges facing students in rural parts of Kenya, innovations like the MLuga app give a gleam of hope that they can access quality education like their peers in other parts of the country. I'm Jusain for VOA News, Wajir, Kenya.
The three U.S. astronauts and one Canadian astronaut are slated to make history in NASA's upcoming Artemis II mission. VOA's Ken Farabo has more on the diverse crew scheduled to make the first lunar journey since 1972.
It's been more than a half century since astronauts journeyed to the moon. Well, folks, that's about to change.
Standing in Houston, Texas, before the current astronaut corps and veterans of the Apollo and Space Shuttle programs, NASA Administrator Bill Nelson introduced the four-member crew of Artemis II, Christina Cook, Victor Glover, Reid Wiseman, and Canadian Jeremy Hansen.
This is humanity's crew.
Reid Wiseman is mission commander for Artemis II, while Christina Cook and Jeremy Hansen will serve as mission specialists. Cook is set to make history as the first woman on a lunar mission, and Hansen as the first international astronaut to take such a journey, something NASA Administrator Nelson emphasized during the announcement.
We choose to go back to the moon and then on to Mars, and we're going to do it together. Because in the 21st century, NASA explores the cosmos with international partners.
Victor Glover, a U.S. naval aviator, will pilot the Orion spacecraft on the 10-day round-trip mission around the moon, testing the functions of the systems and equipment that future crews will use to eventually return to the lunar surface. In an interview with VOA before last year's Artemis 1 mission, Glover said he embraces the historic opportunity to be the first person of color assigned to a moon mission.
People keep asking me, is it meaningful to you that little black kids look up to you and say they want to be like you? You know what? Let's be honest. I represent America. I'm a naval officer and I work for NASA. I represent America. And little white kids, little Mexican kids, little Hispanic kids, little Iranian kids follow what we're doing, because this is maybe one of the most recognizable symbols in the universe.
Not only is the makeup historic, the crew of Artemis II could also venture farther in space than any humans before them, traveling over 1 million total kilometers in a path that extends well beyond the moon before returning back to Earth. NASA says the exact distance and plan depends on a number of factors, including the date of the actual mission launch. At the end of the NASA ceremony introducing his crew, Reid Wiseman expressed the determination of the agency to further its goals in space despite repeated delays and cost overruns.
Three words that we keep saying in this Artemis program: we are going. And I want everybody to say it on three. One, two, three.
We are going!
NASA hopes to launch Artemis II as early as November 2024, with the first mission to the lunar surface as early as 2025. Kane Farbaugh, VOA News, Chicago.
Today is International Day for Mine Awareness and Assistance in Mine Action. Every year, thousands of people around the world are injured or killed by landmines and unexploded ordnance left by conflict. The International Campaign to Ban Landmines' latest landmine monitor shows that in 2021, landmines and other explosive ordnance killed nearly 2,200 people and injured about 3,300. Almost all of the casualties were civilians, many were children. The Landmine Monitor reports that at least 20 countries and regions on the African continent experienced landmine casualties in 2021. The largest numbers were in Egypt and Nigeria. Some of the explosives are left behind from past conflict, as in Angola, but in others, such as Cameroon, South Sudan, and Mali, there is ongoing fighting. Removing landmines is a slow, dangerous process. Many mine clearers have been killed or injured over the past 25 years since the passage of the Mine Ban Treaty. However, Australia's National Science Agency has developed new landmine detection technology. The Commonwealth Scientific and Industrial Research Organization says its handheld device is faster and more reliable than conventional metal detectors. From Sydney, Phil Massa reports.
The Australian device uses magnetic resonance technology that can identify the molecular signature of explosives used in landmines. Unlike current metal detectors, it won't pinpoint bottle-top shrapnel or other unrelated metallic items, saving mine clearance teams time and effort. Similar technology using short bursts of radio waves has helped the mining industry to differentiate valuable ore from common rock. CSIRO scientist David Miljack told VOA that the landmine technology also has similarities with a well-known medical device.
It's a related technology to the familiar things you'd find in the hospital, which is MRI, magnetic resonance imaging. But it's a distant cousin, though, so the techniques we're using don't require that big magnetic field that people sit in. It's just the radio waves that are used. And we're picking up on a molecular signature of the explosive that might be in the ground or the soils.
Australia's science agency plans to send its handheld landmine detectors to parts of Southeast Asia in 2024. Miljack says they'll be used by humanitarian non-government organisations, including the HALO Trust, which carry out mine clearance activities throughout the world.
The plan is, in the next year, we'll take our advanced laboratory prototypes, which are performing very well, but make them really robust and fit for purpose in the field. And that will be through partnerships of our new company called MREED, with NGOs like the HALO Trust.
It's estimated that over 100 million landmines have been scattered in more than 60 countries, causing around 6,500 casualties each year. The United Nations has declared April 4 the International Day for Mine Awareness and Assistance in Mine Action. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Tunisian President Kais Saied has appeared in a video on his Facebook page, putting to rest speculation that he was ill or that there was a power vacuum. According to Al Jazeera News, Saied had not appeared in public since March 22nd, and opponents had called on the government to explain his absence. Appearing alongside Prime Minister Najib Boudin, Saied called the concerned, in his words, a level of madness never seen before in Tunisia. Ahmad Najib Chebi of the opposition National Salvation Front Coalition told journalists that if there was a power vacuum, the Prime Minister would step in. However, a permanent vacancy would present the country with an emergency, since the newly reformed parliament has few powers. Saied says his opponents are trying to create a crisis, and Bloomberg News says the country's general prosecutor has promised to take on persons and social media pages that spread fake news liable to harm public security. And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Douglas Impuga in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent, 24/7, visit our website at voafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbu Yebro, and our engineer, Nelson Lopes, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.